Well, it is This I Believe. And this morning, two members of our congregation have volunteered to share with us what they believe. Evan Oxai and George Taylor will be speaking, and we are going to begin with Evan.
Jim, is that working? Okay. Good morning. I come with my teacher bag of tricks. So, first, thank you for giving me this opportunity to be a part of West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And also sharing today a little bit of my story. Actually, when Rosie asked me to present the next This I Believe, I happily agreed, because who could not? Rosie's so sweet and welcoming and inviting, so I said, sure. But after pondering about my beliefs for the last couple months, I thought, oh boy, I began realizing how scary this was going to be to share such a personal part of my life with all of you. So that I would need not one but two tissues, but a whole box, just in case. And looking back, how I became a woman, a mother, a wife, a sister, a daughter, an educator, and a friend that stands in front of you is an emotional journey. Teaching is my profession for the last 16 years, and because I'm most comfortable in the classroom, I hope you guys don't mind enduring a little bit of fun. So, Play-Doh. What do you guys think of when you see Play-Doh? Please help. Preschool. Okay? What else? Huh?
Kindergarten.
Messy. Messy, yes. Yes, don't get it on the carpet, otherwise it'll stick. Fidgety, yes. And I've taught everything from kindergarten, first grade, third grade, fourth grade, and they get fidgety, no matter what. They need to get moving around. So I'd like to give you a chance to pretend that it's a classroom. It's if you're in the classroom and you need to have something to fidget with. Okay? So like the clipboards, we'll start from the back and have a chance. You don't have to fidget with it. You can play with it and mold it, you know, change it in your mind, change it in your hands as you wish. So if we start back here, and then we'll pass it forward and have fun with it, okay? Just gives you something to kind of play in your hands. I remember seeing one fellowship member, you guys know probably better who that is, who likes to knit needles. And I thought, that's a great idea, you know, because your mind is racing. You're listening, but at the same time, you need to have something to move in your hands. So, as a teacher, I've been used to speaking to a different demographics, and at the end of each school year, I close up my classroom for the summer while reflecting on what my students have taught me. Now, if you don't mind, you know, enjoy your time with your Play-Doh as I take you through the journey of my how I came to be today. When I look back upon both my path to becoming a teacher, I am pleased to see how much of what I believe has helped shape me as a teacher and how teaching has helped shape my beliefs. I learned as a child why it was so important to be an observer and listen and understand the views of others. These have become quite invaluable as a teacher, because if I don't listen to my students, then I'm going to be giving them a lesson that they are not happy to receive. So I have to learn what they want to listen to, what they're enjoying. So as a child, I learned how that I had to make sure the garden was weed-free. The fringes on the carpet were smooth. And our beds were made in military precision. Because this made my father happy. And therefore, a sense of gratification for me that I had achieved something important, my father's approval. So I listened, I observed, and I understood. Now, I continued to do this through my adulthood, but then I started to discover that in order to receive approval, you know, it's because I wanted to be liked. But I soon found that I needed more to be happy. Because I soon realized that making others happy didn't always mean that they would make me happy. Didn't always mean that they would give me the same consideration and care and love. It's human nature. It became clear in my first marriage that no matter how much I tried to please him, he would never take the time to love me in the same way. Maybe he just didn't know how to. So, and 7 years later, with a beautiful child, who many of you know, Nadia, I began to listen and understand myself. I needed to understand what makes me happy. I began to return to the things that brought me joys. Nature. I remember the long walks I took with my mother, learning, discovering, and breathing. Even though my mother is no longer with me, I always feel her, think of her, dream of her, remember, especially when I see a butterfly dancing on a rock, or I feel a gentle breeze rustling the leaves. I believe she's still trying to teach me. I knew that if I didn't change, I wasn't going to be able to be a good mother to my own daughter. So whenever possible, my daughter and I went out for a hike. Something about the silent, mysterious beauty of the twisting branches, bumpy trees, and rich soils brings me a sense of clarity, of peace. This makes me think of one day in college, my roommate said to me, "Hey, let's go to church. It's the college campus. Church." And I said, "Why?" It's like, "Oh, so we can be close to God." I said, "Well, I can go out for a walk." I feel, for me, that was being close to God, my spiritual connection. A friend once shared a book with me called Who Moved My Cheese? And this came at a time where I needed to figure out how to make some changes. And in short, this is a story about friends that got together after a long time, after college, college friends, reunion, and they were sharing about how things have changed in their lives. And one of them shares a story of four fictional characters, two mice and two little people, who lived in a maze. And every day they would dutifully get up and go find the source of cheese, their nourishment, what gave them purpose. But then one day the cheese moved, or just was no longer there. So the mice, two mice, this is kind of a little bit of a joke on human nature, but the mice dutifully said, "Okay, we got to get up and we got to figure out where the next source of cheeses. So they continued on the maze and they searched and searched, and eventually they found a new source. The two little people took them a little longer because they were still thinking, like, wait a minute, we're going to wait here. It'll show up again. It'll come back. But after a while, after a couple of days of getting really hungry and anxious and aggravated, one of them decided, okay, I'm going to keep moving on. I need to find this new source. It was a hard thing for him to do, to make that adjustment. But he, or that little person, eventually did, and eventually did find a new source of cheese. So this book had a lot of great zingers, a lot of great poignant passages that for me I connected with. One of them is noticing small changes early helps you to adapt to bigger changes that are to come. So I guess that's what I have always been trying to do, adapting. I thought to myself, I'm an anthropology major, so I enjoyed studying the different cultures and how in their various cultures there was a constant adaptation happening. For example, how nomads had to adapt to surroundings when they needed to move to find new food or sources. Or more relevant to me, children have to adapt to new schools when their parents move 5 to 6 times or sometimes more. Employees have to adapt to a new boss when there's a corporate buyout. Teachers have to adapt to a fresh batch of smiling, eager faces every year. In my mind, I'm saying they're eager. I've learned when major life changes occur, it's best to adjust, to acclimatize and adapt. But also remembering what makes me happy and trying to find time for a walk in the woods. This is what I had to do in 2008. That was the year my first husband and I divorced. I decided in order for me to become a better mother, I needed to move on. So my daughter and I packed up my bags. My daughter and I moved out. And I started a new job at the same time. So new apartment, new job. But it was a temporary position. Oftentimes teachers, they get their foot in the door by taking a leave replacement position. So that's what I took. It lasted only 4 months. So around December, I knew I needed to start looking for a new job, and I was preparing for that. I had a job interview lined up, but at the same time, something else pretty scary happened. Coming back from a friend's holiday party to my apartment that I shared with my daughter to find 5 fire trucks surrounding the complex. And most of the residents, like 11 o'clock at night, out in the parking lot. And then when I was able to come closer to figure out where the source of the fire was, I realized the flames were engulfing my unit, my apartment, and the two next to me. Needless to say, I broke down in tears. Of course, I'm thinking, wow, I just lost my job, lost my home. What am I going to do? But I kept telling myself that this happened for a reason. So I believed that it was going to get better. So I went to that job interview, feeling scared, anxious, nervous. Then I noticed something peaceful and tranquil. Rays of sunlight, just peeking through winter, gray, dreary clouds onto cold, dismal, winter, frozen earth. Thoughts of my mother, again, began running through my mind and lifted my spirits.
That afternoon, I hugged my daughter with joy and relief, for her mother had a new job. And within a week, at a new apartment, we were adapting. And as you know, this was 8 years ago, and then a lot of adaptation has happened since then. I've had two new jobs. I moved out here to Oregon a couple years ago from New Jersey. And my current husband, Cyrus, has shown me how important it is to be with someone who values what makes you happy as well. I like to think of myself like this Play-Doh, forever changing, adapting, bringing joy to others. I would like to thank all of you for helping me continue to learn.
Good morning.
Morning.
So we've all reset our clocks. We've all voted. We have, haven't we? And now we get to sit back and watch two members of our congregation strip themselves emotionally bare, expose their most eternal secrets or internal secrets. This, I believe. What exactly do I believe? When I told a friend I was about to do this, he said, "What is that? A trick question?" Well, yeah. When Rosie Hamilton approached me about doing this, my first thought was something along the lines of, "Oh, God." Because I knew it would be tricky. I didn't know how tricky. I've been a writer all my professional life, and this is perhaps the toughest writing job I've ever faced. I had to get reacquainted with the me of half a century ago to try to make some sense of what that young person thought, because I'm pretty sure it set the stage for what I believe today. And because when you say, "This is what I believe," you're really saying, "This is who I am." As anyone who's done this knows, that's a very scary enterprise. Let me start with something I do not believe in: God. Not a personal one or an impersonal one, a caring one or an indifferent one, not an omnipotent one, an omniscient one, not even a pastafarian one. Over the course of my life, I have evolved, regressed, from hesitant agnostic to pretty definitive atheist. Years ago, I came to the conclusion that I do not need a supreme being, and perhaps, therefore, I do not have one. Mine is mostly a personal atheism. I have no shred of what we call religious faith, but I'd be a fool to deny that faith exists and that it has great meaning for those who do possess it. My arrogance stops short of telling others that they clearly have parked their brains and all their powers of rational thought to believe the load of dingo's kidneys they spout. I'm glad you're laughing. The fact that I count believers among my dearest friends, whose intelligence I greatly respect, and discussions, arguments, I cherish, helps me keep that arrogance in check. After my "Oh God" moment with Rosie, I thought back to a young kid, I don't know how young, but of a very impressionable age. My parents were not churchgoers, though members of my dad's family were quite religious in their own way. Their church was Dr. M.R. DeHaan's radio Bible class coming out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Growing up, I heard many of Dr. DeHaan's lessons, which were rooted in a literal interpretation of Revelation 21. As some of you know, that one foretells the second coming. Dr. DeHaan, like many evangelicals then and now, believed that this event was imminent. It would be heralded by a joyous singing in the sky, and the Messiah would appear to rule over a new kingdom on earth. If you had been saved, this would be great news. If not, well, not so much. I thought this terrifying event was going to happen any day now. Many nights before sleep, I would listen for the sound of heavenly singing, and sometimes I imagined I heard it. I kept the light on. How could my beloved grandfather, my aunt and uncle, see this as a wonderful thing? I didn't know if I'd been saved or not. I suspected not. We didn't go to church. I hadn't been baptized. It had never been fully explained to me what all that entailed, but somehow it didn't matter. The biblical vision of a promised land held no attraction for me. Saved or not, I was not ready to give up this life, this world, which to me was full of all the glories and promise a person could want. That life was not a privileged one. I can never appreciate what it cost my parents in those early years trying to scrape a living out of the land. Indoor plumbing and hot water that ran right into the house were distant dreams over the first 12 years of my life. We were poor, but there was always food, and I had unconditional love and support from parents who modeled many of the values I hold today. Did that fear overpower any chance faith could have to establish a toehold in my being? Is such a thing even possible? I know that the memory of that fear has stuck with me for close to 70 years. Later, I came to the conclusion that any enterprise that could depend for relevance on scaring the stuffing out of a kid was nothing I wanted to have anything to do with. Lights fade on boy trembling in his childhood bed. Lights rise on him a decade later, sitting calmly on a dorm room floor. Actually, the only light is a candle. I was first on both sides of my family to go to college, which made my parents fairly glow with pride, especially my dad. One of the smartest people I've ever known, he had no chance for school beyond the eighth grade. He was the youngest son of a large family that didn't value education, and he had to go to work. He regretted his lack of education to the end of his life, but his regret never turned to bitterness or jealousy. He remained one of the most open, cheerful, non-judgmental people I've ever known. A man without pretension, utterly at home in his own skin and comfortable with anyone he met, recognizing no differences in situation or status, ethnic background, or skin color. I never heard him make a racially tinged insult of anyone. Politics were another matter. A self-professed little man, a fighter for union rights and blue-collar benefits, he had scant patience with Republicans. When he drank too much Budweiser, as he occasionally did, his true nature came out. He smiled even more broadly. He got funnier and sunnier. He danced. He embarrassed the hell out of his son. His son, who now counts his father's lived values among his own aspirations. My search for a belief system has brought me here to a dorm room floor in the shadow of a stack of books, some of which I still have. The meaning and end of religion, the great religions by which men live, religion without revelation. Sadly, I can find no underlined passages, no marginal notes to suggest guidance I found in those pages. Whatever shards and shreds I took from them, and in an excess of youthful something or other, I decided to found my own religion. In quotation marks, yes. Hey, it was the 60s. The war for us, for the college boys of my generation, was still in the future. After about 30 seconds of thought, I called it Mystic Cult Number 5. Well, it sounded mysterious or something. Yes, it was a gag, mostly. Ritual practice involved sitting on the floor, drinking illicit beer, and discussing serious collegiate thoughts late into the night. At its peak, MC5 extended to maybe 4 college students. It lasted about 3 months and disappeared so completely that this mention today is, I believe, the first time Edie, my wife of 46 years, has ever heard of it. It was a gag, but it served a purpose, too. It was an important transition in my journey from a deep feeling that I ought to believe to acceptance, and yes, even a bit of 60s smugness that I did not need not believe. The only MC5 gospel I recall was one college paper I wrote that has sadly faded into the mists of time. I believe I got an A on it. No, it never mentioned MC5. Of course not. But it did propose the existence of a moral world based on facts, on science, on critical thinking, independent of superstition, of a creator God of faith. In a nutshell, it postulated this. In a healthy society, children are punished when they do wrong and rewarded when they do right. It's how we learn to live a moral life as adults when parents or law enforcement agencies do not watch our every move. It's a compact we make learned in childhood on how and why to behave. An essential part of maturity comes in knowing that moral behavior must be its own reward for the sake of society itself. We demand this growth of our children. We have words and treatments and sometimes penalties for adults who do not learn this lesson. Is it not also then the sign of a maturing community, a maturing humankind, that we undertake to live a moral life without the promise of salvation or the threat of eternal damnation? As we mature as a people, surely we will put aside these childish things. Over the long course of history, I speculated as an 18 or 19-year-old, there were certainly people, leaders, philosopher kings, and probably mothers, whose neocortexes had finally overmatched their reptilian brains. They understood the importance to species survival of a belief system built on empathy as embodied in that moral code we call the Golden Rule. Those not so far along on the empathy continuum would likely need some heaven or hell form of encouragement. And so these leaders, these far-sighted humans, invented some. Man creates God. Okay, clearly. This is simplistic, naive even, reducing religion to a primitive carrot and stick proposition. Even an atheist can see that religion is much more than that. Religion brings a sense of order, that there is a rationality to the universe, to life, an implied meaning beyond our own lives, as long as you have the faith that makes it work. Others can speak of the powerful force that religion and God bring to their lives, and though I don't share, I understand. 3 weeks ago, I sat in a beautiful Anglican church in a small town in Nova Scotia, hearing the sounds of a choir soaring up to the vaulted ceiling, wrapping me in a cocoon of serenity. It was wonderful. I have matured to the point where heavenly singing no longer terrifies me. A year ago, I heard a Bach cantata played in a magnificent bird-shaped Lutheran cathedral in Reykjavik. Oh, my God. The architect, the composers, the singers were inspired by their faith, and that is worth millions. Whatever fuels the creative fires will get no criticism from me. But absent faith, I will find my inspiration elsewhere. In Nova Scotia and in Iceland, I was moved to tears by the genius it took to create the buildings and the music, of course, but also to divine how that music in that place would affect both heart and mind. One of the things I do is write plays. I view theater as a continuation of philosophy by other means. Both are ways we seek to understand our world and our place in it. This line appears in a play I wrote called Renaissance. I believe the world inclines toward perfection, and our purpose is to nudge it along where we can, if only because there are so many nudging in the other direction. I gave those words to Leonardo da Vinci. They are true, I believe, to what he believed, but the thoughts behind them are the playwright's, expressed on a college dorm floor half a century ago. Certainly those thoughts have been sorely tested over the years. In that dorm room, we perched on the verge of great change as individuals, as a country, as a world. Danger signs were everywhere, but so was optimism. A palpable excitement that we, newly educated with new freedoms and new maturity, could be part of a great awakening. As the world matured, we would root out superstition, intolerance, the need for heaven and hell. Well, we all know how that turned out. The world hadn't matured as far as I'd thought, wrapped in my college cocoon, my Western liberalism, my idealistic haze. The world fell apart, split by faction and fundamentalism, and we wonder, can it ever be put back together? Progress is not a straight line. We are caught in cycles of history that play out in seemingly tightening coils, spiraling ever back upon themselves, moving tighter and faster, leading to implosion, to breakthrough. The playwright Christopher Fry once had a character ask, "Tell me, what is your opinion of progress? Does it, in fact, exist? Is there ever progression without retrogression? Therefore, is it not true that mankind can more justly be said increasingly to gress?" Yeats wrote these words 100 years ago nearly, but on the eve of this terrible election, they seem as current as today. "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming." Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. I leave it to you to put a name to the rough beast that haunted Yeats. Its name changes every generation. It is difficult to face the fact that there are some things we do not know and will never know, to accept that things we cannot understand nevertheless have a meaning that does not concern us. We keep to the long view. We hold to the conviction that despite setbacks, the world does move forward. Progress does exist. We will break through. We must believe this because we must make it so. And so we listen to our neocortex, not our reptilian brain. We pay heed to our poet kings. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us, only sky. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Imagine. It's easy if you try, but doing, oh, not so easy, is it? My dorm room cult was never actually meant as a religion. It was a challenge to a young man seeking to reconcile a lack of religious faith with a strong moral compass and a sense of obligation to make the world a better place for his having been part of it. I am no Methodist, but the Methodist's motto speaks both to the young man and to the old man he has become. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. If we do all that, and if we imagine, as John Lennon wished, we can aspire to the maturity that I believed, and still believe, will take us to the true promised land. May it be so. And thank you all very much.
Thank you both for sharing with us. Deeply moving.